At the end of this podcast, you'll learn how you can be a recipient of a free Run Strong, Stay Hungry book.
We're doing a random drawing. You have to participate, but then we're going to do a random.
It's not random.
Oh, it's not.
You come up with
maybe I should listen to the instructions at the end of the podcast.
You have to submit one of your keys to staying in the race with a hashtag. It's not random.
Okay.
We look for the best.
Okay.
And Jonathan's going to comb through them, read them all, study them, put them on the wall, take down the ones that don't belong, and really put some analysis into this.
Get the details to how you can get a copy of this book for free by listening at the end of the podcast.
RX Bar. Scott, let me tell you, they have a new one. Have you tried it? You ordered a bunch of them. Which one do you think it is?
Well, the one that I like is the new one is the maple sea salt. Yep.
Oh, it's so good.
It's good, isn't it?
Mine are almost gone.
Have you done the pumpkin spice one?
That was one
that they threw in for free in the purchase that I made.
Yeah, well, they...
I haven't tried that one yet.
Well, try it. But it's hard not to have this maple sea salt. So good.
I ordered a box for Don and a box for me. I think there's 12 bars in a box. Anyway... RX Bar, they're delicious, they're healthy. Why should you even consider it? Because as a healthy runner, you're trying to find good nutrition. This is good nutrition. There's just good stuff in it with none of the preservatives and any of the crap.
Eat without guilt.
And they are tasty.
Oh.
So you can get a discount if you go to rxbar.com/TRN. You can get a 25% discount off your first order. You have to use the promo code TRN when you check out. Did you get that, Don?
No, I have.
So explain what you have to do.
So I go to rxbar.com/TRN.
Yep.
TRN.
Yep.
And then when I check out, I put in the code TRN.
Yeah, well, that's all you need to do.
And
do you remember what percentage you get off?
25%.
Exactly.
And that's a big savings, Scott. Those are good bars.
They're good bars. Action-heat.com. Actionheat.com.
Do you spell dash, Scott?
You don't. You put the actual symbol, dash. And you don't want to forget the dash because actionheat.com takes you somewhere that...
You'll have to clean up your browser history.
You may have to. But if you go to action-heat.com/TRN and use the code TRN when you check out, you can get 15% off of battery-powered heated clothing. Socks, shirts, jackets... And they're all great. I'm actually going up into the mountains this week to do a little bit of camping. Mm. And I'm taking my undershirt that is battery powered. I'm also taking the battery powered socks because I've become a wimp, Don. And I want to make sure that I'm nice and toasty.
Scott, you're a man of means and you want and you'd like to be comfortable. There's nothing wrong with that.
You know, you don't have to be a man of means to afford these type of clothing because you can get 15% off and it's affordable right out of the gate, even without the 15%.
Absolutely. And I would like to get my undergarment back because
from your sister?
I loaned it to her and she denies having it.
She's probably wearing it.
I know she is. As she denied having it, she was cozy warm with my shirt on.
Again, where do you go?
To
action-heat.com/TRN. And the dash is not spelled. It's the symbol dash.
Yeah. We all know that, Scott.
Tailwind Nutrition. It's that giving type of season. It's the best way to fill someone's stocking full of Tailwind Nutrition.
I think that's what Santa's reindeer fuel themselves with.
Ooh,
completely.
I didn't even think of that.
Well, of course. You didn't know that.
They can stay up all night and continue to run and fly all night long.
And they don't have to get to the salt stick and lick it because it's already in their minerals, all they need, and the calories in their Tailwind Nutrition.
Oh, that's funny.
No, it's true.
It is true. And it's affordable. It's great. It's at all the races now. Almost every race I go to, there's Tailwind.
You know what? It's in every store. It's everywhere. Everywhere I look, Tailwind Nutrition seems to be available.
So be a giving person this holiday season and get some Tailwind for all of your running family and friends.
And elves. The elves, they're on the Tailwind Nutrition product as well.
Oh, I didn't know that.
The one with caffeine, as we get closer to Christmas, they are binging hard on Tailwind Buzz.
Oh, okay. Go to tailwindnutrition.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, of the worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast. with me, a complete imposter here in London, England, and your two real hosts over there with a skeleton behind them very early morning in the studio. It's Scott and Dom.
All right. Are we ready?
Yeah.
There's a bunch of, like, old brothel hookers, like, buried out here.
But I know it's on the upper edge, and you guys have won a couple of awards, and
I've never prepped for a podcast ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing.
Okay, we'll clear that up. That will the Group of the Nation and podcast downloaders are very sophisticated.
They are.
They're unlike any other group out there. They're tolerant. They ignore our many imperfections, and they'll be able to substitute the word. No problem.
They will.
All right. Are we ready?
Yeah. Do you hit the right red button this time?
Got it. Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Don Freeman.
And I'm Scott War. And today we are talking about running for the rest of your life.
Oh, I like that.
There is a book that recently came out called Run Strong, Stay Hungry, 9 Keys to Staying in the Race by Jonathan Beverly. And we have Jonathan on the line right now. He's a journalist. He's actually been the... Where are we starting from?
He's a journalist.
Okay. You're leaving that part.
Well, we're recording now, so I'll fix it. So he's a journalist.
That's how we roll, Jonathan. He's a journalist, and he is the former editor-in-chief of Running Times and a shoe editor for Runner's World.
Ooh, cool.
He's written many different articles. He's a coach, currently coaching a high school cross-country team, and he's interviewed a lot of runners for this book and trying to find out the common threads of those runners that are running well beyond their running lifetimes.
So welcome, Jonathan Beverly, to the podcast. And I've got to ask, there's a ton of books out there, a ton of running books. And you said, you know what? They're missing one. What drove you to take pen to paper and create a book?
That certainly is a good question. There are a lot of books out there. I've got a bookshelf full of books. Most of I've read, but not all of them. But primarily two reasons I'd say I wrote this book. One is that I had time to after Running Times closed down.
Uh-huh.
And second is I started getting old myself. And got to the point where, you know, PRs are no longer possible. And still had motivation to run, but wondered if that's going to continue. And I had friends from, like, Joan Benoit Samuelson. I've known, she was in college when I was in high school in Maine. And here she is, you know, years after her Olympic championship, still chasing it. And guys like Roger Robinson, he was a writer for Running Times, professor of literature, but he ran for 2 international teams for England once, World Cross Country and New Zealand, and set masters records at New York City Marathon and Boston. But here he is, 78, and has 2 replacement knees and still texting me about
his speed workouts. And he's named his knees, and his new one just set a PR in the 5K of 40-something minutes. But here's a guy who, you know, used to run 220 marathons as a master's. So I wanted to find out from people like this and others, you know, what is it that keeps not only healthy and going all these years, but hungry and chasing it and wanting it still.
Yeah. Let's get into that. But before we reach into that part of the discussion, let's just talk about why we stop.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you led the book with that. Let's lead the podcast with that. You know, every runner has in the back of their mind, there's a day. There's a day that you're told, either someone tells you or you tell yourself, my running days are done. And we all regret that, and we don't want to see it happen. That's why this book's important. But let's talk about some of the reasons we might stop. What would take a driven athlete and have them hang up their shoes? You mentioned a few things in there, and one of the things is just losing your drive. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I talked to at least a dozen people that had stopped. I mean, some of them are really good runners, and it seemed that several of them got to a point where it just wasn't worth it anymore, that the effort of getting out there and pushing themselves the results weren't measuring up to what they felt the cost were. And that, again, you know, talking to people who continued, I got some more clues about why that is. But these people, I mean, they sound even, you know, seems appropriate, sort of like, yeah, I've been doing this, it's hard, I've reached the end of my goals. I don't have any goals left. And anything I do now, you know, to get to a level that I feel acceptable, it's going to require way more effort, and probably won't even be able to do it. But the key there, you know, is what, you know, that acceptable level, their perception of what they needed to be to feel good about themselves, was at a level that they couldn't do anymore.
Jonathan,
and that could have been. Yes,
I was going to say, have you through the research of this book, have you? Could you say that most of the people that hang up their shoes are the faster, more elite competitive runners? Or are they more of the recreational mid-pack, rear-pack runners?
Many of them that I interview were the really top, you know, Olympic-level athletes, or setting records, or even just you know, sort of front-of-the-pack road racers, used to being in that lead pack, you know, getting age group awards. That's not entirely. Those tend to fall away again because expectations, because they're used to winning. They've gotten used to that level of success, and when that goes away, the running itself was to get that. That success became the reason. Others fall away. The mid packers, I think, fall away more because they lose the habit. They fall out of the habit. And they fall away, and then it becomes a lot harder to come back, or they get injured, and again, you know, after injury, it's just too difficult to get back into it.
Yeah, I've often wondered about that. The podium, the guys and gals standing on the podium, much tougher to slip back in the finisher's time than it is for us in the mid pack. You know, that's, you just get to meet new people when you slip back when you're in the mid pack, but up front, you no longer get to stand up there and. Many times that's what drives them. That's why they get up before the alarm goes off. That's what lets them do, you know, things that are hard, because they love that competition and excelling.
It motivates them to eat spinach and kale for every meal, right?
It could, yeah.
But then the training, all of it, yeah, becomes the means to an end. The end is except to win. And if you can't win, why run? Yeah, that feeling.
Do you see that once these runners lose their drive and fall out of a regular running routine, do you see that, do any of them come back? Is it a temporary thing, or is it, I'm done running, now I'm going to go golf?
I talked to a few that came back, but it seems quite difficult. For the same reasons for anyone else, is that once you've fallen away, your body changes. It becomes just a lot harder to do it, and so that even the running, even if they adjust their goals, adapting to that is really hard. I mean, I think that it is hard to go and come back. But I did talk to also a couple that did midlife. Decide, you know, like went to his kids' track meets and started saying, I still enjoy this. I should try again. And yeah, you know, he said it was the hardest thing possible to get a 50-year-old body to start training again. But but he has, and he's come back, and he's, you know, running well, not the level he was before. No, none of us do 50, but enough to feel good about himself and set goals and be training again.
Do you see some that hang up the running shoes but pick up a kayak or pick up golf shoes or pick up something else that they don't have to measure their past against? I used to be able to do this.
Yeah.
There's no use to us when you pick up a new sport. Have you seen that trend?
Yes, I see that very often, both mid-packers and then, you know, at the level of like Joe LeMay, who was a, you know, Olympic caliber marathoner. He's now rowing, and he says, you know, don't have the burden of the past, which is the theme. You know, people that aging is not difficult if it wasn't for the memory of what you used to be able to do.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so and I've actually. Oh, go ahead, Jonathan.
yeah, just a new sport gives you that freedom to be a beginner again, and you're not comparing.
And if you know, I've done this. I've done different races, so I don't have to compare myself to my you know, personal best time on that one. I don't want to face the music that, man, you're 4 hours slower than you used to be. Who wants to hear that song? And also you can start to pick different distances, you know, things that you really didn't, weren't the top of your game, and you continue to run, and a new challenge is almost a distance. Different distance can be as different as another sport, because a 5K is much different than a marathon is a 100-mile run.
Yeah, it really is. And different venues. Yeah, go do a mountain race. Yeah. You don't have to compare it to what it is. It's brand new.
We talk, and this is, we're just going to throw this one in there, and I don't know how much thought you put into it, which is usually the best questions. We talk about stop running as a lifestyle, but how about why we stop when we're out there on an actual race? Did you explore that or think about that through the questioning and interviewing of some of your athletes?
I did not, but I think probably some of the same principles apply. That you get to a point where you say, you know, I had these expectations, I had these goals, I'm not going to be able to meet them, so I'm going to throw it in. Wow. Again, sometimes that might be logical, you know, if those goals are the reason. But I've rarely met somebody who didn't drop out, who didn't regret it later. And say, you know, if I could have just hung on, just adapted, and that's the key here.
It's learning to adapt. And Jonathan, as I looked at the three reasons that I wrote down in some notes, because I did take notes for this one because it's a great book, I wrote down things get in the way, why we stop. And it applies to not only lifestyle, but also to the race. Just like you said, things get in the way, like a blister, like a, you know, whatever might get in the way. You lost your goals. You know, you had your A goal, it slipped away, you went, ah. And because of that, you lost your drive. And those are the three highlights I picked out of that chapter, and it applies not only lifestyle, but during the run too. So I think you did think through it, and it applies to both. So that's interesting.
Yeah, that's cool. And I agree that things get in the way, which also I think is key as far as setting goals. I ran a marathon again for the first time in 8 years this summer, and I had a number of goals. And my last goal was the James Brown, if it takes all night, it'll be all right. I'm going to finish this. You got to have that goal somewhere out there.
Yeah.
Hey, Jonathan, as you were beginning to put your ideas together for a book like this, I'm sure you came up with some theories or maybe even came up with your own list of maybe why you think people quit running. What surprised you the most as you were interviewing these runners that may have been a revelation to you?
Are you speaking of the ones who quit or the ones who continued?
In any revelation that you had as you were interviewing all these runners, I mean, you went in with an idea of this is the book that I'm going to write. And as you're interviewing them, you may have went, wow, I never even thought of that.
I better write that down.
Yeah, I better write that down. That may be part of this book.
Yeah, so that's the question.
Okay, let me give you three things that were surprised. I didn't have, you know, as far as saying you come into a research with an hypothesis, that these weren't on my hypotheses. One was I expected a lot more structure to training. I expected to find a bunch, you know, these detailed training logs, and this is how I've done this, and this is how I've adapted. You know, that people would say, I used to do 80-mile weeks, and now I do 60, and I used to do these, and I got some of that. You know, these speed workouts, and this is how I modify it. But almost across the board, I found that these people who have succeeded, even from the time when they were young, they learned to run by feel, that they really pay attention to their bodies, and they kept emphasizing it's much more important to be adaptable that way and to let it happen every day than it is to try to figure out all the numbers, because the numbers don't work, you know, from day to day, and they don't work difference between you and somebody else. So that's the first one. The second one was probably how many people, again, the chapter is about, it's called humility and hunger, but how many of these people who are just amazing runners, I'd say 100% of them at a certain point in the interview would say, you know, I never was that good. I really wasn't the front of the pack. I didn't beat many people. I didn't. they really had a perception that there are other people better, and that they weren't, you know, they weren't talented. Which ties in again, as we just said, the people who stop are the ones who tend to be good and think they're good and know they're good, which gets into the mindset of are you running to prove that you're good, or are you running to improve and to have a growth mentality. But I found that was so universal and so important to longevity.
Yeah, and if I may submit, before you do number three, so I think of those people, as you were describing that, some run to prove that they're fast and win because they have to prove something. Others just win because they happen to be fast. it's just who they are, and they're happy either way.
Yeah.
You know, whether they're on the podium or if they just given their best effort, they're just love running for the sake of running instead of using running as a means to identify who they are and what they are and their value, you know, to others. So yeah, I think that's a great trait to have in our champions, just humility. Yeah,
and it was so cool. It's so universal. You know, somebody like Benji Durden, who was, you know, Olympic on the Olympic team in 1980. He didn't get to go, but he was an Olympian. He ran 209 marathon at one point. But hearing him talk, I kept expecting sort of the point where, you know, this is where I got good. This is when I became the elite and, you know, got the Nike contract and went and lived in a bubble. And it wasn't. It was just I just tried my best all the time, and you know, and eventually it was this level, and now he's, you know, he's had cancer for a couple of years and he's running 4-hour marathons, but he's still, it's exactly the same attitude now as it was then. There's no change. It was just, yeah, I tried my best and I hope to improve. That word hope is probably the last one that it took me a while to get my mind around. I mean, a number of people had some pretty serious things, like Benji's cancer or Roger's knee replacements, or found out they were diagnosed with diabetes, that would have stopped people, and they did not stop them. And I thought, okay, well, that's just sort of the characteristic of them. They've got grit, they've got perseverance, but began to realize that it was the characteristic of all these people is this idea of hope and belief, or optimism, you call it, belief that you can make a difference. You can become better, regardless what that is. I once heard Jay Johnson, the Nike's number two employee, talk about he had a stroke, and he said, when you go to the rehab ward, you can tell the people who are athletes because they believe that they can make a difference. That, you know, if I apply myself, if I work at this, I have hope that I will be better. And that, again, was that chapter got added after even I had submitted the book outline and got approval for it. I came to the realization that this is key to all these people, is that they have this optimism, and it's a learned optimism that comes from the humble beginnings, that I wasn't that good and I got better. And having learned that, they still feel that way all the time. You know, it's not a permanent thing, that this is where I am and it's all going to go downhill from here. It's like, okay, this is where I am, but I could still get better.
If you put a bunch of people on the top of a filter and you shook this filter and out popped long distance, long duration runners, those are some of the characteristics that this filter would drop out, running being this filter of positive, optimistic, you know, people that are there just love the challenge. And I think that's why, as a community and as a culture, that we end up with people that get along pretty well and identify with each other, because they've all been through this filter that has popped out like traits and like characters and things that we all hope to achieve. So, yeah, I think that's why we get together as a pretty tight community. And you meet somebody brand new on the trail or on the road or wherever you're running, or in the airport with a running bag on, and you can pick up a conversation pretty quick and feel like you know them and become acquainted pretty easy while you're waiting in line somewhere.
That's very true. And that's also, you know, talking to these people, I felt very quickly, it was like, you know, I going on a long run with everyone. It never was a formal interview. It was just, we just started hanging out.
Do you find that, you know, you go kind of go back to this organized, your number one surprise, a detailed structure. Do you find that some of the technology that we use today, whether it's Strava or whether it's a GPS watch or even the old fashioned logbook, that sometimes that stands in the way of us enjoying and keeping us engaged for the long run?
Yeah, I think it really does. And I'm still getting my mind around this because I've spent a lifetime logging things, and I like to have the quantification. I think a lot of us do. It's mm-hmm. nice to have to sort of it validates us. But I think it really gets in the way with the ability to adapt. What happens seems to me that we start to think that what's important is the numbers in the log or the Strava feed or the splits we hit, not what happens to the body. And these people who are able to continue and adapt, I think are much more aware of what's about is the effect on my body. Yeah. And so if I'm headed out and I'm trying to apply this to myself and really having a lot of fun with it, is this fall, instead of, you know, laying out a training program or saying on Tuesdays I'm going to do speed work, just heading out and if I feel good, I'll start doing some pickups, you know, 4 telephone poles all on, 2 telephone poles off, or whatever. And you get back and rather than checking the splits and stressing about it, you get back I have my Garmin on and find out that I've done, you know, 8 to 10 times 400 at 5K pace faster than I normally did. But it was all fun. And whatever the details of it are irrelevant to what happens to my body. My body's getting faster and stronger.
So go ahead, Scott.
I was going to say, you know, along with that training by feel, I wonder, and it's things that this is something that I kind of think about and worry about is we've also on this podcast talked about dedicated training. That's not the right word.
Purposeful training.
Purposeful mm-hmm. training. So, you know, maybe you train by feel. Let's say that like this week, I'm not feeling real energetic. I'm gonna only train this number of days. But does it come down to a day, the morning of, where you've said, today is my speed work day or today is my hill repeat day, and you go out there and you start into it and you just go, no, it's not here. I'm gonna cut back now. Or do you push yourself to finish that dedicated training schedule, that one day? What did you find out from these long time runners? Did were they able to give up, or did they say, I'm going to do this today, and they're going to do it regardless of how they feel, that they're going to push through?
Surprisingly, I found that most of them would adapt, that if mm-hmm. it wasn't happening, they wouldn't. Having said that, they all would give a hint. You know, they would say that's what they do, and I think they did do that, but they all would give hints in terms of saying, you know, they head out every day religiously, you know, some words like that, that they still had the discipline, and then once they had the discipline, they could adapt. So the default was, I'm going to do it, I'm going to finish it. That's sort of given. But when things aren't going well, when the workout's not going to produce the results because it's not happening today, or you're going to get injured, they were able to back off and adapt and then add it another time.
Yeah, I think you stated that really well, that there's kind of a battle that goes on between discipline and training by feel. I like that.
Yeah, for sure. And it's, I think, what we're really afraid of, to go by feel. I think the reason that most of us avoid that is we're afraid that our, you know, if we pay attention to our body's going to say, you know, I'd rather be on the couch today.
that would be me.
I think I would rather sit on this couch and eat Cheetos all day. That's what I feel like.
There has to be the structure, and I think you learn by it. One of the guys I quote in the book, Gary Allen from Maine, and he's run, you know, sub-3-hour marathons for 5 decades, and one of these religious trainers. But he says, you know, you need to learn to be a chef. I think that's a process. You know, when you start, if I wandered in the kitchen right now and was going to make a souffle or something, I wouldn't have a clue where to start. I'd have to pull out a book and find a recipe and follow it exactly to make it work. But after doing that a while, if you're focused on it and disciplined on it, you learn what each ingredient will do, and you can start playing with them. And I think that's sort of along the spectrum. It is a process of learning not only what the ingredients do, but learning your own body and response and what it feels like. And then you can combine those and taste it. That's a lot of people would say they don't know what the workout's going to be till a couple miles in. And they become so adept at reading their own body. You can head out and say, you know what I need right now is just a bunch of really quick sprints to loosen things up. And so you do it and you feel good about it.
That image went into my mind as you were painting that picture of this chef cooking without the cookbook, as you referenced in your book, just all there by instinct. And I could see them reaching into that sauce and then tasting it and thinking, you know, it needs more salt or garlic or whatever they're putting in. And you would say we should run the same way. We are out there, we put ourselves out there, and then we adapt as we're in the middle of it. And I think that's a smart way to train, because that's how you have to race. You know, a race has to be something that you adapt on the fly. Absolutely. It never, ever, ever goes exactly as planned, at least for me. It's never a spreadsheet race, but there's always some adaptation. So we've got to learn that while we train. And I like your analogy of the chef in the kitchen with his spoon and as many ingredients and no cookbook.
Yeah, for sure.
So how do you go ahead. I've got a question after your comment.
Yeah. Okay. It really goes together with, you know, you talk about what I want to do is sit on the couch is learning to love the run. Not only too many of us think about all of this is just sort of training. Again, it's all a means to an end, and the end is then to race fast, which kind of distorts it. I think, I mean, if we were honest, we'd say that the run is intrinsically valuable, and what we really like to do is to run well and feel good. And if that's our motivation, then it becomes a lot easier. I think even the training by feel side is not okay. I've got to discipline myself to whatever the schedule says so that I can race well at a certain point at the end. But I want to run. I want to feel good. I want to run well. I want my body to be at its peak at what I can do today. And so then you realize, you know, what feels good right now, I should go long today. And so that tomorrow I'll have more endurance, not because the schedule says I should do it.
Yeah, I've talked to a number of runners, I'm sure as you have and maybe experienced yourself, that it's not all about race day. It's about the runs up to race day that's so enjoyable. So I love the training, and the race is just a bonus. I just love training and getting out there and doing it. And if you're intuitive and you cook without a cookbook and run without a spreadsheet during your training, I think it can be more enjoyable because you're not forcing yourself to do the grind, even though it's not right for you. Your body's telling you, hey, you need more rest. You've done too much speed work. The knees are a bit sore because you've been hitting the downhills pretty hard. If you listen to your body and adapt, I think we can embrace and love the sport even more if we're not making it a labor and a punishment, but running for pure joy.
Yeah. And realize that it's a choice. Every day is a choice.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you come across that fork in the trail, the short way back is available, and you never seem to take it. It's nice that it's there and available, but you always I'll go the long way. Here's my question. How do you then training by feel and trying to keep it simple, and what do you notice with the heart rate monitors? How many of these athletes are training with some of these biofeedback mechanisms? Is it something that's critical, or they've learned to use it and now they've thrown it away because they've listened to their body now entirely, or what did you see?
I found with the more experienced runners tend to have outgrown it. However, everybody agrees that it's another good method of learning. But to use it just like you use your splits or anything else as a tool to say, okay, so this is what it feels like at this level. And until you are fully aware and being able to monitor yourself without that, it's a good tool to gauge it. Let's say, yeah, tempo run is supposed to be about an 85% level. Look at it, get yourself to that point, and then pay attention. I think too many people, it becomes a crutch. And instead of using it as a tool to pay attention and learn, it's what they rely on. They just look at it, and if, no matter how they feel, oh, I've got to be at, 145, I'm going to push to that, even if that's too hard, in the perceived effort.
How about breaks, Jonathan? We're talking to Jonathan Beverly. Run strong, stay hungry, and stay healthy, and stay hungry. And it's important to stay hungry. I blew that.
You blew what?
I forgot my question. What the heck? It was a good one, too. Man, that was my best question.
I'll pick it up, and you can remember your question.
Okay.
All right, go.
Okay. I was going to say, as you were talking to these people, running by feel and all that sort of stuff, do you find that most of these runners are running with a training partner or a group, or are they running solo? Is there some kind of a common thread there?
Good question. And it was one that I started to ask people as the interviews went on. And what I found is people almost universally say that they like to run alone, that the majority of their miles have been alone. Having said that, they say, I love it. I love running in the group too. I love with other people. But if you can't run alone, if you have to have other people to get motivated and to get you out there, you're not going to survive. That you have to learn to love the solo run, the quiet time, the quiet discipline of just getting out there every day in order to survive all the things that happen in life. You move to a new town, your training partner gets injured, your training group falls apart. What are you going to do if you're relying on them? And even just the logistics of it, of getting together with other people, it makes it harder. I mean, one of the big things is just finding time to do it consistently. And people who survive are the ones who, whatever moment in the day they have, then they can just strap on their shoes and head out. That's a lot easier than having to meet somebody every day at 6 o'clock.
My question came back to me.
I knew it would.
Well, good. As you talk to these athletes about longevity, about staying running for all of the many decades, did you come across the conversation about forced breaks, stepping away and being okay with it, of allowing yourself a break without feeling guilty or the sense that I'm falling out of shape, I'm getting overweight? I mean, all the things that kind of go along with stepping away that ultimately, I don't think are true. I think you get stronger, you recover, you get hungry again by stepping away. What did you find in that topic when you spoke to your people?
There's a dual thing going on here with breaks. Is that consistency is one of the keys. You have to stay fit enough to be healthy and strong in order to continue. I mean, the reason people get injured more likely is not that they're doing too much, but they ramp up too quickly. So people tend to run every day or regularly, enough to keep strong and to keep going at this level. That said, everybody also was willing to take a break and not it had the identity of a runner to know that just because I'm not running this much this week, I'm still a runner, and I'm still the level of runner. I do think people get in a lot of trouble with that too. That they even though they should be taking a break, they've got a tibial stress fracture, but they're still out there doing it because they can't accept that if I don't run today, I'm not a runner anymore. and one of the best people was Pete McGill out of California. He's run a 15-minute 5K at 50. But he's taken some pretty serious breaks, and he says, his Achilles are acting up. He can barely walk. He just says, I'm done. I'm done as a runner. He tells himself that, knowing sort of in the back of his mind that what he's saying is what I'm doing is not working. I've got to back away. I've got to reset. I've got to figure out how to fix this, and then I'll be back again. And and he'll take whatever time it takes. I mean, he says he took about a year off recently and he's doing other stuff, you know, keeping fit, doing exercises, figuring out, and then he's willing to come back. And I think it's a good perspective. It's hard for a lot of us. I went to a podiatry conference talking about my other book, the Stride book, and those guys talking about surgeries and people. It was a good window on this. They're like, oh, I had this surgery and had a really good recovery. 16 weeks later, they were back. And thinking about what that feels like, 16 weeks of not being able to run. Most of us feel like, yeah, we're done. We're never going to happen again. But from their perspective, they're sacrificing a season for a lifetime. And I think that we need to have that in mind sometimes.
Yeah, Stride book. We want to reserve you in the future for. I just like the. You got me at the title. You had me at Stride. that's certainly very topical. Hey, I don't expect you to have an answer for this, but we're on a podcast and we're just, sitting around the three of us. We can speculate. All right, so we don't anticipate going to a journal and finding this number you're about to come up with. What percentage of our potential do you think most of us achieve? We let a lot of things get in the way. Maybe we overtrain. Maybe we don't diet. Our diet isn't conducive to performance. Who knows all the things that maybe we don't prioritize. What do you think the percentage of potential that the average mid-packer is achieving? And I'm not talking about the people on the podium. I think they're very close. I think they're in the 90, high 90s. They've reached that potential. That's why they're on the podium. But there's a lot of us that are kind of in the middle. Do you think we reached that 90 or do you think we're well short?
It's an interesting question. And I guess I would just pull it out of the air, say a lot of us maybe are happy with 70%. Having said that, I think the way we get from 70 to the... whatever, like you said, 95% of the people who are on the podium isn't by just training harder. I think we have this perception of perfection out there that, if we could just put everything right and not have the demands of our lives and not have our inadequate bodies that we'd get there. The people that I interviewed, that it was one of the really things I'm still working my mind around, seem to have more the idea that it's just about getting the most of what they have every day, and that adds up, and that ends up getting them to that level. It's not waiting for the perfect time when you can really give everything to it and everything goes perfectly. It's every day giving more, and that's where we fall short. We compromise on the day to day and then hope that we're going to do great at the end.
Yeah. I like the way you said that 70%. And that was kind of in my mind too, about 70%, because I think a lot of us don't either have the time or the interest or the something to string all of those things right. And so here's what I'm thinking. If we're at 70 and we decided that, hey, I don't sleep enough. I have a lot of sleep deprivation. I try to make my day into 27 hours and it's just not possible. And I sacrifice sleep to make that happen. What if you plugged back in the sleep? You would then increase from 70 to maybe 74. And what if I worked on strides and I tried to do some of these drills that we talked to Mark Krukazella about? What if I did that? That might raise me, because I don't do them now. Maybe that raises me to 77 or 78. And just having some discipline and using some tools that are out there that we've talked about or heard about or read about or listened to others talk about, if we start plugging those in, we could start with the same effort, like you were talking about, Jonathan, this training just as hard, but training smarter and differently, we start to move ourselves a little bit closer to the podium and away from the 70% of our potential.
That's brilliant. And I agree. And I see that. And again, I think we sabotage it. If it's not all perfect, then it's not worth doing this little part, this little bit. But all those little bits are adding up to 30%.
Yep. Yeah. And for some of us, mid-pack might be full potential, and that's okay. The real race, the real challenge isn't to get on the podium. It's to be your very best and get as close as you can to your 100%, whether that's cutoffs, mid-pack, or on the podium, doesn't matter. It just matters that you you just maximize your potential and your effort to realize that based on my effort, I've gone as far as I can. So, Scott.
I was going to say it brings up the point, one of the topics that you talk about in this book is that these people that are running for a lifetime are students of the sport.
Ooh, yeah.
So they're always learning more about it. And frankly, that's one of the things in my life that motivates me to get out on a training run every day is to try something new. And fortunately, Don and I have been very fortunate to do this podcast. And we learn from some very, very smart people like yourself that we can apply. And I think that that's real important to become a student. Once you've feel you've quit learning everything there is, then I think that you kind of maybe lose some of that motivation.
You kind of lose your drive and no goals left and things get in the way.
Yeah.
Just like Jonathan said.
Yeah. you know, one of the other nice things, and I want to get your opinion on this, you mentioned in the book, is to connect at a different level. And I may be paraphrasing that quite liberally, like I always do.
Oh, Scott, I guarantee but you, it's not even
there,
close.
There is a section in the book, and I tried to find it. I read it, and I can't find it right now. But where you talk about where these runners connect at a different level, whether they are coaching or whether they're riding or whether they're volunteering at a race or being a race director, tell me how that helps people connect and stay involved in running themselves.
Yeah, this was I think key number 7 or something. But the key there I found was multiple layers. One is it gets you out of your own head. You know, that you see somebody else and you see their goals and you see how they react to success and failure and it gives you, you know, a little bit of space there, a little perspective, and you realize, you know, there's somebody that you're coaching and they feel like if they don't run a 17-minute 5K, it's not worth going on. It's like, okay, well, this was a tough course and you place better on the team than you ever have. You got this narrow vision of what success is. And seeing that helps you, you know, get away from your own goals. The other thing I saw was it just keeps you in connection with the passion of the sport and with what's going out there. Again, you see somebody else putting it all out there and progressing and having success. That's exciting. It's motivating. And you want that for yourself. And then finally, I think it helps bridge the downtimes. Yeah. When you're not doing as well or you're hurt, you're still in connection with it. And so you still could see yourself as a runner and part of the running community. Whereas if you're out there, you know, and again, you have to take 3 months off and you don't see any other runners, there's not much to get you back into it.
You know, how has coaching your high school cross country team, how has that helped you become a better runner, or has it?
It's invaluable. I'm pretty sure I would not be still running and running at the level I am today had I not done it. First of all, as much as I enjoy running alone, it's great to have a group and have the accountability. Part of my goal, people ask me, I tend to set race goals, you know, during the spring and then come fall. It's like, what's your goal? It's just be fit enough to keep up, to be part of this group. and that's enough. I mean, and that's great. And then, as I said, to see that whole process of becoming a runner, of seeing somebody realize that it's not necessarily, I mean, it's great. I've had the one guy that the senior this year, you know, worked his way up every year since I coached him since seventh grade, ended up 14th at state this year. Those people are great, but it's also great to see the girl who came out every year for 4 years and she was like a, you know, 28 minute 5K runner. And then every year get it a little bit more and end up, you know, last runner on varsity, you know, like breaking 25 minutes, but huge self-esteem. And she's one of those that, you know, she graduated and I'll see her out on the roads running and becoming a runner and becoming more of a person because that, I mean, there's nothing more motivating than to see that and wanting it for yourself again, too, to realize, okay, I can again, that hope. I can become better. I can set a goal. I can make myself a better person.
Jonathan and Scott, do you ever drive by a runner without looking at them?
No.
I always study. Do I know them? How's their gait? How fast are they going? Could I keep up with them?
What shoes are they wearing?
Yeah.
No, that fuels my passion.
You feel connected.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Oh, absolutely.
Hey, Jonathan, are you, after writing and doing the research and writing this book, are there things in your coaching that has changed? Are you a better coach, or have you changed up the way that you coach because of this book?
Well, I hope I'm a better coach, but yes, I definitely changed some things this year. And primarily it has to do with this section we talked about, the humility and hunger section, that I think too many coaches, myself included, tend to identify people, you know, that you know, you say, you know, even at junior high level, say, yeah, you've got a gift, you're good at this. This is something you should pursue. I think that's dangerous because it sets them up to be, you know, this fixed mentality of I'm good. I'm good at this. And then their only choice becomes either proving that they're good or failing, as opposed to treating everybody as the same, as sort of come out, reward them and encourage them for working hard, praise them for progress. Instead of praise them, you know, we tend to you know, say, good job, you medaled this time, as opposed to good job, you know, you ran 5 minutes faster, or good job, I could tell you really focused on kicking, and that was one of your goals, and you did that. Those are the things I think the coaches need to focus on, the progress goals and the effort goals, more than the absolute success.
I have a question on longevity, back to longevity for a second, and consistency. And do you notice, or can you see any pattern of West Coast runners versus just snow-based runners, and locations where there's snow, where they're forced to shut down their running? In Northern California, where Scott and I are, there's no excuse on any day not to get out there and run. But when you're living in snow country, you've got to change your sport a little bit. You've got to maybe do snowshoe or Nordic skiing or cross-country skiing or something. Have you noticed that there's more longevity in places where you're forced to change sports?
Interestingly, I love this question. And I don't have enough data to prove this, but my gut and my experience tells me, and people I talk to, that the people who live in the harsher climates and the four seasons, I think, tend to be, it's easier to have longevity than those who live, you know, in San Diego, where you can get out and run any day. And I think a couple of reasons that is that the seasons, the physical seasons, help you take seasons in your life too. As you said, either doing other sports or just, you know, more likely to, you know, you're not going to have a race every weekend. And so you're going to spend some time building a base, and going a little easier and striding a little differently. I mean, there's that variety factor. You run differently in snow than you would on, yeah, in the middle of summer. So I think that, and then I also think that the beautiful climate all the time probably lures you into doing too much. That the people who are, again, live in a place where it's possible all the time, go out and end up getting hurt and then have to come back.
And Jonathan, thank you very much. This is a great topic. I know that there are many out there that have contemplated this question, you know, when or if I'm going to wake up and be done with this sport. There's probably some that are listening to this podcast that have taken a break, whether it was a forced break because of injury or something else, a lack of motivation, that are looking for those reasons. This book gives some keys to running strong for a lifetime. The book is called Run Strong, Stay Hungry, 9 Keys to Staying in the Race, where Jonathan interviewed, I think it was over 50 runners to get the content and the common threads that are found in this book. It's a really good read. It's a quick read. We highly recommend it. I also, while we're on the podcast, went to Jonathan's website. It's jonathanbeverly.com. We'll link it to the show notes. And you can see his other book, Your Best Stride. And there's actually a section that shows a lot of articles that he has written, which are the clickbait titles that you gave those articles, Jonathan. That's probably your best writing ever, because there were about there's about 20 on there that I think I'm going to go read after the podcast. So
awesome.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you for the book. It's really been an education.
He said nine keys. We didn't catch all nine keys.
So no, you got to read the book to get nine keys.
You got to get them all.
They all work together. It's synergistic. You can't just take one, pick or choose.
Do they have to be in order?
Don't have to be in order.
Oh, that's good. That's good. So, Jonathan, thank you so much. We appreciate the book and you sharing it with us and sharing this time with us as well.
It really has been my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Can we commit you to maybe doing some book stride book that you wrote? We'd love to dive into that someday. Yeah.
I would love to at any time. As you can imagine, there's some correlation between the two. But yeah, that was a lot of fun to write and to research and to implement.
And one of the things that we failed to mention, we may even put a little plug at the beginning of this podcast, is the publisher has agreed to give us to send out two copies of this book to some fortunate listeners.
So how are we going to arrange that, Scott? I mean, we have two books that we can give away. How would you like to make that happen?
I don't know. What do you think, Jonathan? Do you have any ideas on how best to get these out to the right people?
How about we look for people to add their keys? I came up with nine keys, which somewhat arbitrarily. I know there's a lot more out there. So how about this, that looking for key number 10 and number 11, and people could put it on social media, hashtag run strong, stay hungry.
Nice.
That's good. And then next Thursday or Friday, you'll pick from those two lucky winners, and we'll send them a copy of this great book.
Cool. I like it.
Sounds really fun. So they could do it between now and next Friday, the 22nd.
Correct? Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
All right, Jonathan, thank you again for your time, and good luck looking through all those keys to find two that fit.
All right, thank you. That'll be fun.
It might be the start of your new book. You might have 18 keys to staying in the race, so it'll be good.
Yeah, it's going to be a good one.
Okay, thanks, Jonathan.
Sequel. Thank you.
The sequel, part two.
Now go out and run.
Mass.
You know, sometimes after you hit stop on the record button,
some gold comes out.
Some gold comes out. We just heard some gold. So with this last comment, share that with us, if you would, Jonathan.
Yeah. As I get to know runners, I think that trail runners and particularly ultra runners are much more suited to longevity than road racers or track racers, because it seems that the issue is to keep going on a trail race. And you know that you're going to have difficulties and you're trying to overcome them. Whereas road racers and trackers just seem to try to control all the variables, make everything perfect. And
figures.
Well, this whole podcast has been a hodgepodge of restarting and starting as we lost connections so many times. And even with our last little sound bite, it stopped.
You know why? It's because of net neutrality.
Is that
It's shutting us down. I think that's what it is. I'm joking, of course. Maybe I'm not. Maybe it's not.
Well, this podcast took about twice as long as you see on the recording there, because it was a bit of a challenge.
Well, just like any good trail training run or race, you have to adapt, and I think it turned out okay. It's a great, great book. You should pick this book up.
Jonathan Beverly is a great runner and a great guest, as he tolerated all of this technology glitches. And it wasn't the audio engineer's fault, by the way.
Oh, really? Okay.
Some engineer.